From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in April of 2008 when the United States Supreme Court reached a 6-3 decision upholding Indiana's voter identification law. That law was considered to be the most restrictive voter ID law in the country, and it was founded on the belief of Indiana Republicans that there was a near epidemic of actual or potential voting fraud going on. Legal challenges went all the way to the Supreme Court, where Justice John Paul Stevens joined the court's conservatives in ruling in favor of Indiana's law. Stevens wrote that the concerns about overburdening some voters was overblown, while conceding that the law would, in fact, not be justifiable for some voters. It was a significant blow in favor of a country that has, in a country that has seen increasingly restrictive voting access laws, especially in the last 20 years. And the story is detailed in a book called Voting Rights, Under Fire, The Continuing Struggle for People of Color. Author Dr. Donathan Brown called Stevens' writing shallow and fraught with the same errors that previous judges had made in deciding that most voters would have no trouble with heavier restrictions. Brown is assistant provost and assistant vice president for faculty diversity and recruitment and professor in the School of Communication at RIT. And the book first came out in 2015. Fair to say that a book's worth of material has happened since 2015, including the heated debate about what the New York Times called a full-scale meltdown of new voting systems in the state of Georgia alone. Today is a primary and special election day, of course. What have we learned about voting restriction, access, and fraud? Our guest this hour is Dr. Donathan Brown from RIT and the author of Voting Rights Under Fire, The Continuing Struggle for People of Color. Dr. Brown, welcome to the program. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you for having me.
I want to get back to Indiana and sort of the history in a moment here, but could we just ask you briefly, the last 5 years feels like its own book. And I'm wondering, you know, how you sort of assess where we are today with people voting today in person or having already voted early or by mail here in Monroe County, but in very different situations across the country based on rules and restrictions. How serious do you view the situation today in 2020 vis-a-vis 2015 or 2008 or pick another year?
Sure. I think, unfortunately, that the system is operating as designed. To disenfranchise certain communities, particularly communities of color throughout the country. If we look at just the time frame of 2015 to present, what we see are a continual lapse in judgment, as I would call them, looking at states passing voter identification laws on the fallacious basis of protecting voter integrity. And so as we continue to look across the country and look at the laws and how they've been interpreted, how they have been upheld in the courts, it is very clear and evident to me that many of these are simply smoke and mirrors, because at the end, we're still waiting on proponents of these laws to show their work, to show their evidence, to support the claim that in-person voter fraud is both real and widespread.
There has been a consistent theme for years now, typically among Republicans, though, as the book points out, I mean, it's not always the case, that there is this specter of voting fraud that actual voting fraud has occurred or the conditions are ripe for fraud. You are pretty clear in the book, very clear, but why don't you, for listeners who haven't studied this and hear either the president or often national Republicans or political commentators talking about fraud and how it can cancel out their vote and dismantle democracy, and we need these restrictions because of the fraud. What do you want people to know if they can't pick up the book and read all of it? What do you want them to know about the oft-invoked fraud concern?
Sure. I think one of the most immediate examples I would point to, simply to remind people of both 2016 and 17, when Donald Trump became president-elect, he did so under the claim that 5 million or so people voted fraudulently in the 2016 election. Now, this followed the 2017 creation of the White House Voter Fraud Commission. And in their 7 or so months of operation, not only did it disband, but in doing so produced no evidence whatsoever that voter fraud is real. Now, this is startling because, again, this was a claim that we heard repeated over and over again, not just by Donald Trump, but other Republicans in places like Pennsylvania, I think Mike Turzai, for example, and others, who are saying that we are facing an epidemic of voter fraud. But at the end, we continue to look at Texas, at Arizona, at places throughout the country and find that there is no evidence to support the claim. So for those who are very curious about this subject, I would simply ask folks to take a look at the case law, take a look at the arguments being proposed and supported by the state. They're not citing evidence. They're not citing a widespread outbreak of voter fraud. Instead, their arguments oftentimes are couched in this idea of voter integrity.
Why is it that after the president's claims about 5 million fraudulent votes in the 2016 election, of which he has never produced a shred of evidence, why is that not met with equal opprobrium on all sides? And I think there's a difference, Dr. Brown, between saying I'm concerned that the conditions are ripe for fraud versus the elected president says 5 million people voted fraudulently, and the answer is probably close to a few dozen across the country. Why isn't that, you know, either disqualifying or raising a concern for all of his supporters? In the same way that if Joe Biden said the same, it should absolutely provoke the same kind of opprobrium, but it doesn't. Why do you think that is?
Sure. I mean, there's so many different reasons we can talk about here. I mean, we could talk about the news cycle. I mean, you and I both remember following this very closely, sure. And it simply fell out of the news cycle. And as a matter of falling out the news cycle, it fell out the consciousness of the nation. We were talking about the passage of the Voting Rights Act, which needs to be renewed. And again, the news cycles are ever so clear that after 28 to 48 hours or so, we simply stop caring. But I look at it this way. When Donald Trump made the claim that 5 million people voted fraudulently in the 2016 election, he was very clear that these votes did not go toward his campaign, toward his election. They were, in fact, intended for Hillary Clinton and not him. So as we think about this and think about some of the comments that were made by Mitch McConnell and others on the question of Election Day as a holiday, it becomes very clear from the very beginning that this is old wine in a new jug. We are not trying to systemically enfranchise. We're doing quite the opposite of systemically disenfranchising. And by, quite frankly, looking at ways in which we can continue to arouse public suspicion around voting in the process itself.
Paul Weyrich was an American religious conservative political activist and commentator. And he was a figurehead of what became known as the New Right. He co-founded the Heritage Foundation, the Free Congress Foundation, and he coined the term moral majority. So this is someone with a lot of currency in his lifetime, died in 2008. But he said in the 1980s, he said, I don't want everybody to vote. And he essentially said that we don't win elections if more people vote. Now, since the 1980s, when he said this, it's a lot quieter now. President Trump has sort of implied at times, a little bit more directly at times than others, that if more people can vote, the results will be poorer for his party. But typically they fall back on, oh, no, it's about the integrity of the system. It's about fraud. Weyrich's comments seem to give away the game almost four decades ago. And yet we're sort of still playing around with this idea that it's about the legitimacy of elections. It's not about suppressing votes. Why wasn't that a moment that changed things? Why wasn't that sort of disqualifying? Because I imagine if I were to say that, or anybody were to say that, it would be sort of disqualifying.
Right. I mean, one of the ways in which I talk about in the book is that the structures that we have in place, the comments that you just made, all serve at the pleasure of enacting the status quo power structure. And so these individuals who are making these comments are accurate, unfortunately. The person which you cited, completely accurate. I mean, we know this from many years, and you can look over the past century of impacts and cases and laws and such. But the question is, at the end of the day, it all comes down to those elected officials and people actually caring enough to show up to the poll, one, but that's a problem in itself. Individuals who actually believe this is a problem, again, it's not understood as a widespread issue in itself. Republicans and Democrats, African-Americans, whites, moderates, conservatives, liberals, all have a different perception on what the issue is. And so for us, this is what we continue to see played out over and over again. Some people believe it's a problem, and you know the foghorn has sounded many years ago. And others see this as, oh, no, this is more so about keeping our elections with great integrity. So there's just a widespread dynamic of who's understanding and who's accepting and believing what.
Listeners, if you want to call the program or interact with us, we would like to hear from you. And if you have real concerns about voting fraud and integrity, and you're convinced that that's a real common thing to guard against, and that we should be very, very restrictive in who can vote and how they're allowed to vote, we will engage with that, and our guest is happy to do that. If you've got questions about the process, or if you want to weigh in with how you think the system is working or not working as it's intended, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. So, Dr. Brown, why don't you take us to Indiana, because you focused a section of the book on Indiana. Sure. There's a number of states done a number of things, but take me through the story there. Take our listeners through the story, and then I kind of want to talk about some of what judges have said and some of the legacy of that kind of law.
Sure. The state of Indiana gave us Crawford versus Marion County, that infamous 2005 case, essentially let the state of Indiana proceed in enacting a strict voter identification law. Interestingly enough, during that time, the Reagan-appointed judge Richard Posner sided with the state in allowing that to go through. Now, here's the interesting point, because Posner played a key role in this decision. In Crawford v. Marion County. And why I disagree with him, it's fairly fascinating to see that in 2013, Posner came out on the other side, if you will. In a book he wrote, he discusses, quote unquote, pleading guilty, if you will, to not knowing the problem or the association of disenfranchisement caused by voter identification laws. In his view, and as he wrote in 2013, these laws were designed systemically to disenfranchise. And so when we think about Marion County, Crawford v. Marion County, and looking at the ways in which the state provided no evidence, right? The state's argument in that case was that, well, there will simply be no one who will be disenfranchised as a result of this law being passed. And so again, we talk about voter fraud in the public square, but when you get into the legal realm, the question then becomes, well, no one's going to be disenfranchised by it, but however, as we see throughout the country, in Indiana and other places, that was simply not the case. So Crawford v. Marion County was a landmark case in voter identification law.
And you had a judge, and forgive me, I don't remember her name, but there was a judge before we got to the Supreme Court saying, you know, look, if you want to complain about this law, the plaintiffs have to prove that there is injury here. You have to prove that people have been adversely impacted here. John Paul Stevens, Justice Stevens, wrote in the leading opinion at the Supreme Court level, 6-3. He joined the conservative justices. Here's what he wrote about this. And keep in mind, these are his words about Indiana. But this is really about voter ID laws across the country. Here's what Justice Stevens wrote. Quote, "The relevant burdens here are those imposed on eligible voters who lack photo identification cards that comply with SEA 483. Because Indiana's cards are free, the inconvenience of going to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, gathering the required documents, and posing for a photograph does not qualify as a substantial burden on most voters' right to vote or represent a significant increase over the usual burdens of voting. The severity of the somewhat heavier burden that may be placed on a limited number of persons, for example, elderly persons born out of state who may have difficulty obtaining a birth certificate, is mitigated by the fact that eligible voters without photo identification may cast provisional ballots that will be counted if they execute the required affidavit at the circuit court clerk's office. Even assuming that the burden may not be justified as to a few voters, that conclusion is by no means sufficient to establish petitioners' right to the relief they seek." Again, that's that is Justice John Paul Stevens, a progressive justice siding with the conservative majority, and you were critical of what Justice Stevens writes. Take me through it.
Yeah, in fact, I still am critical, to be quite frank, because I certainly understand the argument, and this is something that we saw play out in the state of Texas when they attempted to enact their voter identification law under the same argument that, well, the identification needed is free. This would not disenfranchise anyone because we're not attaching a cost to it. And so when I think about this decision and I think about other states who've used that same line of argumentation, here are three things to consider. First and foremost, as we saw play out in Texas and in Alabama and other places, in order to get these free forms of photo identification, you would need to appear in person at a DMV facility. And what we saw throughout the closure is that, well, DMVs were closing, right? We saw them in the Black Belt region of Alabama, where we saw many of the counties close their DMV areas in rural, largely historically Black areas. We saw the same thing in Texas. And so part one. Part two is that even with these DMVs open, some of which operated in reduced hours, so we're not talking a 9-to-5 schedule, maybe 9 to noon and other examples. And three, we think about the documents that are needed to procure such photo identification, such as a birth certificate. And if you don't have that birth certificate, obviously that bears the cost. And I'll add another one here. Four, if we think about transportation, how is someone to avail themselves to a location, to a DMV facility in a rural area that may not have public transportation? And so as we think about this idea of free, while on face value that may be the case, but in reality, on the ground, the implementation of this can't be further from the truth.
That, to me, seems like such a good deconstruction of the argument of free that I'm surprised Justice Stevens wasn't compelled by it. How much damage do you think Justice Stevens' words have done in the ensuing 12 years?
You know, I look at Justice Stevens' words and I compare him with Judge Posner's words, quite frankly, in the fact that Posner was right out of the gate 6-8 years later to simply say he was not aware that such laws were designed to disenfranchise until watching continual cases move throughout the court. And so I look at Posner, I look at Stevens, I look at everyone, I look at the other state laws, and we're coming out the same end. I see no difference here than in Kentucky, than in Georgia, than in Alabama, than in Texas, than the words of Posner or anyone else, quite frankly. We're all heading toward the same collision course, unfortunately.
Yeah, and when you think about getting to a DMV, for example, gathering the documents, getting there, showing the documents, going through the whole process, it is true in one hand that, I guess you could make the argument that that everyone has the opportunity to do it. Mm-hmm. But it seems obvious that fewer people will do it, that a number of people simply will not, or for a number of people, they will decide the burden is too much because of the reasons you talked about associated with what the word free might mean in air quotes. Does that to you indicate that the intention here is pretty clear? If the intention is not to prevent future fraud or injury to the integrity of the process, the intention is just to be logical, to know that fewer people are going to vote, and that's the goal.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we've never satisfied the case or the claim in this country that voter fraud is real. Let's start from the very beginning. And so as we continue to work down that, it's a simple mechanism of disenfranchisement. We don't want you to vote, plain and simple. We haven't wanted certain communities to vote ever since the very beginning. I mean, we can, even looking at the passage of the 15th Amendment or the 19th Amendment to present, we see that we have still enacted barriers along the way to prevent certain communities from participating in the democratic process. So I think you're absolutely right. It's not about fraud. It's simply systemic disenfranchisement.
Let me get our first phone call. Cheryl in Pittsford first on the phone. Go ahead, Cheryl. Are you there, Cheryl? I think we have.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I'm here. Yeah, there you go. Okay. Hi, Cheryl. Go ahead.
I had you muted because it was, you know.
I got you.
I just am curious. Like, I personally, you know, I do think that voter fraud is a problem. I do. I kind of get nervous when, you know, we don't get to go to the place and vote, but that's just me because that's how I grew up. But that's not really why I'm calling. I'm really wondering, I mean, I feel that the two-party system is kind of horrible and that it's not helping, and we're not getting candidates on either side because, you know, I'm not a big fan of my local government nor my state government right now, and I haven't been for a while. But, I mean, how I don't understand how we as an American people can't come together and figure that out and find some good qualified people to run maybe not as a Democrat, maybe not as a Republican, because it's tough to say that I don't vote party line. I am a Democrat. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that. I don't vote for Democrats all the time. I vote for who I think is going to do the right job. And I don't think that happens in this country. And it's really apparent right now, in my opinion.
Yeah. So, Cheryl, before we dive into that, which I think is a fair and important point to weigh, can I just ask you a little bit about why you say you do have concerns about voter fraud? You mentioned a little bit about growing up and going directly to the polls yourself. But what's the evidence that makes you worried that there's a problem?
I want to be able to go there and pull my own lever. You know, I mean, I know it sounds silly. It really probably has nothing to do with the fact I really just want to do it myself. I don't want to mail it. I want to be there. I want to, like, you know, I want to put the, sure. I want to put it in there. You know, I guess that's what I want.
Yeah. Oh, no, okay. Mm-hmm. I hear that. So, Cheryl, first of all, thanks for the phone call. And there's two different prongs to work through. Let's talk about that voter fraud aspect first. So, Dr. Brown, she's worried that if you can't go and pull the lever in person, so to speak, that it's a corruptible process.
Sure. Yeah. And you know, the interesting thing is this. If there were evidence or traces of voter fraud, and I write this in the very beginning of the book, my book would take a much different direction. And so my problem here is this. Under no circumstances will we allow any of this line of argumentation to stand for anything else. Let's say you take your car to the mechanic, and they say, oh, looks like you're going to need a new transmission. Oh, tell me what's wrong with mine. Well, I can't really point to anything specifically. I can't prove to you specifically that you need a new transmission. But just for the car's integrity, you may need one. We don't accept that line of argumentation for anything, quite frankly. And this applies to the voting structure here. I understand that folks have fears and concerns about voting, and whether it's about voting in person or mail-in ballots or things of that nature. But I think what we're doing here is putting a so-called solution before a problem even exists.
Okay. Well, right now we're having a national conversation, I guess led by the White House, where President Trump, despite having voted by mail many times himself, and his White House press secretary having voted by mail in the most recent election herself, and many prominent conservatives who are ripping this idea of more vote by mail this fall, having voted by mail many times themselves. It sounds like it's a good for thee, but not for me idea here. That, well, I can vote for mail. That works for me. But if you want to do it, then I'm worried that it's your ballot's going to be corrupted.
Yeah, and we continue to see that. I wasn't shocked nor surprised by it. And, you know, I think you summed it up perfectly. And I'm very curious to see how this continues to play out as we see more and more mail-in ballots that have been directed throughout the United States. But again, I'm struggling to figure out the relationship here, the argument, or even the evidence, quite frankly.
Yeah, and I will just say to listeners, you know, we're going to be on the air tonight. We hope you join us on WXXI Radio tonight at 10, I believe, Megan Mack. 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock. Yeah, I should know this. I'm going to be on the air live tonight. It's primary. 10 o'clock tonight. But we don't expect, and we're not going to have final results because a significant number of ballots are mail-in ballots, much more than usual, understandably, during the pandemic. And they're going to count those days later. They're going to make sure that they do this slowly and carefully. So it could be the end of next week before we have primary and special election results. I am fine with that. And if there are reports of any sort of corruption, confusion, struggle. I mean, we want to know, but I also don't want to spread misinformation because that leads to fear and that leads to the kinds of policy that is detailed in this book, Voting Rights Under Fire, The Continuing Struggle for People of Color. The kinds of policy that seeks to remedy something that isn't actually happening with the consequence of excluding or limiting, especially certain parts of the population. And so we want to know, we will report as best we can as to how this goes. And I hope it goes very, very well. If it doesn't, as a journalist, we're going to be reporting on that. I'm sure Dr. Brown would consider all of the evidence there and seeks to do so coming forward. But are you concerned, as we head for November, Dr. Brown, that that the president of the White House could seek to discredit the national election before it even happens if the polls aren't good or if they feel that that is the best way to kind of add chaos to a process in which chaos may benefit them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at this point, let's just take a look at what's happening already in places like Atlanta and Louisville. We're seeing folks who, Louisville being a great example, city of 600,000 people, one polling place. And so we are already anticipating results like Atlanta, where we saw last week where individuals were in line for 3 or 4 or 5 hours just waiting to cast a ballot. And so as we think about this, we're already in turmoil. We have passed a point of turmoil. And so I think you are accurate in saying that we can certainly expect the White House to continue to fan the flames, if you will, frustration, confusion, and overall anxiety about the voting process moving forward.
Is there anything that we can learn from today? And I mean today as in the election that's technically happening today, but it's been happening, and what we're going to see in terms of the results. In other words, if it's smooth, if it's run very well, is that sort of a harbinger of what may be to come in the fall? And conversely, if there are struggles, would that concern you? I mean, are there lessons in this one?
I think so. I look to Louisville on this one here. When we think about voter identification laws, Louisville will enact their voter, or the state of Kentucky, rather, will enact their voter identification laws in November. This comes after a veto from their Democratic governor, but it was overrode by their majority Republican House and Senate at the state level. And so as we continue to see more voter identification laws come online, one, that's a problem. As we continue to see across the country consolidated voting locations where you have a city of 600,000 people voting in one location, that is a problem. Add to that the conversations that we're having right now about fear and fraud. And let's be very clear here. We're still in the pandemic. We still have COVID-19 in the background. And so all these things are unfortunately ingredients to a perfect storm.
If it goes pretty well with the primary, at least locally, should that quell some of the concerns about increased totals of voting by mail this year?
I would hope so. I would certainly hope so. I mean, locally, I think there's a lot to be proud about. I think there's a lot of things we've done as a state to improve access. So my hope is that things go according to plan and take it from there. We won't have much of the vitriol that we see at the national level.
All right. Let me do this here. We've got a couple more phone calls we want to take. Oh, you know what? To be fair to Cheryl in Pittsford, she also was just asking about, you know, recruiting people to run for office. So I'd like you to address
right.
that point. She's feeling like she doesn't like the slate of candidates she sees. Some of it she kind of chalks up to a two-party dominated system. How do you see that?
Yeah, you know, I teach a course called Race and Public Policy. It was a seminar course I taught 2 years ago, and we had this very same topic of conversation. And two things came up out of this conversation that really hit upon the message of the previous caller. The first thing is the cost of admissions. In other words, how much does it cost to run for office nowadays? What is the average cost to run for the House, to run for Senate, to run for president? And two, how accessible is Election Day in the United States? And we talked about ways in which Election Day could possibly become a holiday. We're allowing more individuals to exercise their right at the ballot box. And so I certainly understand, but I see these are two barriers of entry that we're still dabbling with.
Our guest is the author of the book, Voting Rights Under Fire. Dr. Donathan Brown is with us. He's assistant provost and assistant vice president for faculty diversity and recruitment and professor in the School of Communication at RIT. It is, of course, primary and special election day. I'm Evan Dawson, and let's take our only break and come back to more of your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson, Wednesday on The Next Connections. We've now had 2 full weekends since New York State has moved into a phase allowing restaurants to have indoor seating. So are people going out to eat? Are they comfortable with that? And how are servers and staff at restaurants feeling about the experience? We're going to talk about it with servers at local restaurants. We'll get your take, too, on Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Herman in Brighton, next on the phone. Go ahead, Herman.
Hello. I have two questions. The first one is, what is the most effective thing that ordinary citizens and activists can do to try to counteract or get rid of all these voter suppression tactics? The other question is, the turnout of black voters in 2016 was down significantly from 2012. Was that primarily due to voter suppression laws, voter ID laws and stuff, that were implemented following the Supreme Court decision that undermined the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act? And could that have been the margin that cost Hillary the election?
Herman, thank you. Dr. Brown?
Yeah, so one of the things, and I'll take the first question, or the first portion of the question first. So what people can do to rid voter ID laws and voter suppression, I frankly think people have to start caring. As we talked about, this is being such a quick news cycle. We talk about voter identification laws and voter suppression, and within 72 hours, it disappears from the headlines and thus far disappears from our consciousness. I would certainly encourage people to get involved. Look at ways and look at candidates who are openly fighting voter suppression. Look at movements across the country and organizations and people who are fighting voter suppression. Be informed. Take a look at case law. Take a look at outlets such as the Brennan Center and other places that produce papers and other sort of documents that talk about voter identification laws and its suppression of African Americans and other communities of color. The second part of the question is looking at turnout and voter ID. Is there a relationship between the two? When we think about and have this question, we're looking at what causes turnout and what does not. One cannot dismiss the role in which voter identification laws play. As we talked about, many voter ID laws are piecemeal. One state has one set of requirements, another state may have another set of requirements, amongst other things. And in doing so, if we think about the ways that we have seen DMVs either close or reduce their hours in some areas and some counties that happen to be majority African-American or other people of color, it makes you wonder. And so as we think about voter turnout amidst voter ID, I think it's certainly more than plausible to look at the connection between the two, look at the closures of DMVs, the reduced hours and others, and developing a more holistic understanding of what's happening before our very eyes.
Here's an email from a listener named Charles who wrote before the program began. He said, quote, I anticipate at some point someone will claim that requiring the presentation of identification prior to voting is voter suppression. Well, every time I've voted, I've presented my ID. It was no inconvenience, and each time I was thanked by the individual I handed it to because it made it easier to locate my information. If it's no inconvenience and it makes a poll worker's job easier, there is no legitimate reason why one shouldn't be required to show government-issued ID to vote, especially when one considers that it's required to buy alcohol, board an aircraft, and operate a motor vehicle. That's from Charles. Dr. Brown?
Sure. I think let's take a moment to define the terms here when we talk about inconvenience. As you and I really deconstructed this idea, the term free, we're looking at ways in which many of these outlets or forms of identification aren't free. I mean, we think about boarding a plane. We know that there are costs incurred there. But as we really follow the election history throughout the United States, looking at ways in which even after the passage of the 15th and 19th Amendment, we have constructed barriers all throughout America, poll tax, literacy tax, voter identification laws, closures of DMVs, reduced hours, amongst other things. This must be understood within the grander context of the system by which it was born out of. So I completely understand the writer's point of view here. But as we specifically talk about communities of color, we must keep the context within the content of the current conversation. And so when we talk about inconvenience, for example, I think we may have to agree to disagree here that the level by which we're talking about here are completely different.
Jane in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, I've got a lot of little things. I'm going to try to be brief, though. Let me ask you this first to your guest. When you change parties, which I have, they are sending me to another precinct. Is that because it's a special election? Why would I be changed to another precinct? We usually vote right downstairs. I'm in an apartment complex of 400 plus, and it's been real convenient, you know, with that. And now I have to go somewhere else. I wondered if it's because of the special election. All I did was change parties, and and I've got all the information that they sent to me showing that, you know, I am a Democrat now, you know, verifying all of it. So they got it right down there, but I got this notice that I have to vote over on Reservoir Avenue. So do you know what in the world could have caused that? I've already voted one time Democrat, and that went fine. So it's not the first.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Dr. Brown?
No. I do not know.
You don't know? Why they changed
it? I do not.
Okay. And then I just want to share that it happened to me in 92 and 1996 when Clinton was running and I was living down south. Those are the only two times that they stopped me and, no, you're not on the register. Well, I always bring all my information with me from the mm-hmm. Board of Elections, and that usually stops them pretty cold. So she said, oh, you know, it really irritated with me and went back through the stacks. And both times in 92 and 96, she found what she needed to say that I was, you know, qualified to vote and register. So that was a contested little precinct that I was in. Mm-hmm. And other times I was in a solidly Democratic, we called it the black side of town. And so I don't think they care, but I think that I was a Democrat, and they, you know, you come in, you have to sign a Democratic a list, or on another table, a Republican, so they knew I was a Democrat. Also, when I came in, there were seven, and I came in at 8 when the doors opened. I was the first one in. They had to unlock the door. And there were 7 poll watchers, and I looked at who had voted, and there were 7 votes for Republicans. Now, I always thought you had to have a balance of Democrats and different people from different parties, but there were 7 of those, the poll workers were Republican. Is that legal?
I don't know. I don't know the exact, Dr. Brown?
No, neither do I. I would have to have a better understanding of the local policies and procedures.
It's reactionary.
Okay.
it's reactionary. And then this other thing, just to show, this doesn't flatter me at all, but a few years ago I messed up 2 ballots before I got it right. And the worker said, you just get one more. And they got someone to help me, but there were others voting at the same time who were also still having trouble. It's like you needed a ruler to see which candidate, which party. And, of course, we got me through that. And let's see if there's anything else. But it just now I have to go to a new place to vote. So you don't mm-hmm. really know. But they do these things, you know, like say, oh, you're not in the register. And if you don't challenge it, you'll just walk away not voting. And I disagree with having to have identification. To get identification, I had to pay for that here. My driver's license was expired. That would have cost mm-hmm. me a cab and so forth. And that's the situation with others also. Thank you so much.
Jane, thank you. Anything you want to add, Dr. Brown? I mean, I wish I could help more.
Yeah, you know, not knowing the local policies that are governing the election by which you're speaking to, there's not much I can say, unfortunately. But I certainly thank the caller for sharing her thoughts and comments and experiences nonetheless.
And here's Jerry who writes, I have served as a poll worker. We are trained not to ask for voter ID in New York State and to tell people to put it away. Voting stations must be staffed by a balance of a poll worker from each party at the tables. So Jerry just adding some information. She says, in the April 2017 issue of the University of Pennsylvania Gazette, available online, the UPenn Law School did a study that found that Republicans had engaged in a long-term policy of systematic gerrymandering, which was aggravated by voter suppression far more than had been done by Democrats. So that is Jerry just jumping in as a poll worker with a little bit of information. Pam in Rochester says there are fewer polling sites during the pandemic. She thinks they're consolidating, so polling places are changing. So if your polling place has changed today, and we've heard from a number of people that it has, we are certainly hearing that there are fewer total polling places today in Monroe County, significantly down, and that's probably true in a lot of places. We're trying to make sure that we understand everything for you, and some of this is directly related to what Dr. Brown talked about. Some of it's just dealing with the pandemic, a lot more vote by mail, and trying to anticipate need and demand. but we'll be covering all of that. We'll get back to your phone calls in a second. Let me read another couple of quick comments for Dr. Brown. Rachel says the following, along with your first caller, my concern is the scanners that count our ballots. When I pulled the lever, there was no way my vote could be changed. The current system does not include generating a receipt that confirms my vote as I cast it. Long ago, I heard that a majority of these scanners were manufactured by companies that were primarily donating to the GOP. As a result, I cast my recent votes by mail and will continue to do so until the process is more transparent. That's from Rachel in Canandaigua. Dr. Brown, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, election machines have come under scrutiny. Just last week, we saw scores of reports coming out of Atlanta about polling machines that were simply non-functional and being taken offline for various reasons. So I think there's a lot we can do better in this country regarding voting and voting rights. And unfortunately, election machines are one of those areas in which we can certainly do a better job.
Let me read a comment from a listener who occasionally sends racist emails says the following. Says, only a few dozen cases of voter fraud in the 2016 election is an exaggeration on the low side. We need IDs to buy alcohol, airplane tickets, car rental. Why not require photo IDs to vote? It just sounds like you have a low opinion of people of color.
Well, I would certainly, again, I'm asking individuals to sustain the burden of proof here. If, in fact, we are relying on voter identification to rid this idea of voter fraud, then show your work. What is your evidence to sustain the argument that voter identification fraud is real? We have yet to have a sustained argument. Again, as we mentioned at the top of the hour, the claim that 5 million people voted fraudulently in the 2016 election, years later, that claim has been unsubstantiated, and we can look across the board to find unsubstantiated claims here. And so, again, as I continue to think that we have a so-called solution to a problem that simply does not exist.
Michael writes, I know conservatives who believe that the only reason that Obama got elected twice was because so-called illegals voted for him. I try to explain that you have to be an American citizen to vote, but they believe what they hear from Rush and from Fox. It seems to me that Democrats need to do a better job of proving that voter fraud basically doesn't happen. That's from Michael. What do you think, Dr. Brown?
Yeah, you know, I think there is an opportunity for Democrats to make a stronger case. I think there is an opportunity for Democrats across the country and Republicans who may feel as if voter identification laws do disenfranchise to have that conversation, to have that debate in the open. Because at the end, when you call upon individuals to show their work, to prove their point, to present the evidence, as we saw with the Voter Fraud Commission within the White House, nothing firm exists, so it certainly is an opportunity.
Another listener wants to know, so what is your ideal system of voting if it's not what we've seen with recent reforms? Dr. Brown.
Yeah, sure. I like a lot of what I see within recent voter reforms. I'm thinking two things we can do away with immediately. One, we need to reform the Voting Rights Act, first and foremost, to ensure that protections are engaged across the country to ensure that disenfranchisement is never an outcome of attempting to vote in this country. And next, on a more localized level, let's think about ways in which we can enact same-day registration. I mean, there are other states, and we've done a great job in 2019 with early voting and pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, but I think we can go one step further with same-day registration.
What do you make of what you've seen in Georgia recently that the New York Times has essentially called a disaster?
I agree. It is a disaster. As we talked about earlier, having individuals in line for 5 hours in some cases, in other cases, 3 and 4, is simply untenable, unsustainable. The idea that we have people, amidst a pandemic, mind you, standing in line outside with other people for that long to cast a ballot, in my opinion, is a system that is perfectly functioning as it was designed initially. And so I agree with the assessment. It is disastrous in every sense of the word.
You also write in your book about Pennsylvania. You write about what's happened in Texas. And, you know, different states have different rules. Have we learned anything from different states and their move toward restrictive access that indicates any of those measures is based in evidence or is based in sort of sound policy judgment?
No, not in my opinion. I think the idea that we are seeing more and more is a fallback on voter integrity. And so I really call on individuals, and I've asked to simply define the terms. What exactly do we mean by voter integrity? Are we looking at our belief in Congress? Well, approval ratings for Congress continue to be dismally low. I think one bright spot to point out is in 2018, I believe it was, in June, where a federal judge tossed out a Kansas measure that had essentially required proof of citizenship requirement to vote. And so I think we have small victories in small places across the country, but we need to do a far better job by connecting the patchwork into one unified frame.
John wants to know if your guest is so confident in voting by mail, is he willing to vote by mail?
I already did.
Simple as that. You want to elaborate? I mean, it's pretty sound to you, huh? Pretty simple.
Again, I'm not going to go any further than to entertain any sort of tactics about buyer beware, about voting in person without an ID or voting by mail or whatever the case may be, because as I've stated over and over again, the case has simply not been made. It has not been sustained that there is something to actually fear. And so when the case is sustained, when the evidence produces itself, I will be the very first one to review the evidence accordingly. But until then, I see no harm.
Your book, Voting Rights Under Fire, details a lot of the evidence. It takes a look at the attempts of states to make certain changes, what the courts have said. And you make this case, step by step, that the evidence hasn't really mattered in a lot of places, that it's essentially just politics. It's about political control. If the evidence doesn't matter, is there hope that there will be widespread reform of voting restriction, voting access in this country?
Yeah, I think there's two ways to look at it. First is that the courts have paid great deference to the state and have taken their concerns quite serious without necessarily requiring the proof to sustain the argument. And my hope is that we will continue to see a reversal on that, as I mentioned with a lawsuit in 2018 out of Kansas. Next, I'm hoping that this Congress, perhaps the next Congress, will really look at ways in which we can have more federal guidance on elections by again enacting a new Voting Rights Act, because until then, we're going to have piecemeal and patchwork done across the country that requires certain forms of identification, no forms of identification, amongst other things. I think if we're going to be serious about elections, serious about continuing our mission to make sure that communities are not left behind, to ensure that retrogression is eliminated in the voting process, that we continue to look at the upcoming Congress, we look at things that can be done locally as well as on the state level. So there's a lot of intermoving pieces within that.
And you note in your book that, for example, Ohio and Wisconsin have reduced the opportunity for early voting and imposed wide-ranging restrictions. That's an interesting pair of states, because in the primary process back in March and April, when the pandemic was in its early days and moving toward a peak and not away from it in many places, you had the Republican governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine, defy what a lot of folks in his own party were saying and say, we're not holding an in-person primary. It's too dangerous. Poll workers tend to be older. People who vote most consistently tend to skew older. It's a more at-risk population. And we can reschedule this for June. We'll do it a different time. We're not doing it now. Meanwhile, Wisconsin holds it. And in more conservative areas of Wisconsin, there were more polling sites. Milwaukee, as you know, many people have covered, had like five. I mean, it was ridiculous lines. And so at the time, a lot of people thought, well, Ohio is the state that is being the most careful and considerate there, and good for them. You know, doesn't matter who your political party is ruled by. And of course, the Democratic governor of Wisconsin agreed with the Republican governor of Ohio. The Republicans in Wisconsin moved the vote forward. But I guess I want to close by asking, maybe we shouldn't read too much into those kind of moments. We should look at policy. We should look at not just what happens during a pandemic, but the move toward access, same-day registration, and other policies as well. Yes?
Yeah, I most certainly agree. I mean, these are short-term victories within the moment. And for us and for the classes I teach, I always ask individuals,
to turn off the television and tune out the pundits and look directly at the case law. Look at the evidence before you. Look at the arguments being made at the state and local and federal level as we try to get a better understanding. We need policy reform. We need a better legal understanding of voter disenfranchisement, because it's clear from Judge Posner's piece in 2013 that there are some judges that are simply not caught up to speed on the relationship between voter identification laws and disenfranchisement. So for me, it always comes down to policy. Until we have real policy change, I think these will be short-lived victories.
Dr. Donathan Brown is the co-author of Voting Rights Under Fire, The Continuing Struggle for People of Color. Thank you for making time for the program and for answering a lot of questions from listeners on a subject that I know it comes up often, certainly on a primary day, but this is central to this country and this republic. And thank you for making the time for us.
Thank you for having me.
I hope Dr. Brown will join us again on this program, because there's going to be a lot of debate about access, about reforms and policies. And we need to keep having these conversations. If you are interested in what's going on today, and I know a lot of our listeners are, I'll be on the air tonight, 10 o'clock, as we break down what we know about primary day. Don't necessarily expect results tonight. We don't, but that's okay. We are going to talk about what we know and what people have been reporting. And good luck to you if you're out there voting today. Share your thoughts with us. Rob, Megan, and Evan saying thanks. We'll talk to you tonight.